This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate that took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of March 11th, 2008. This series of debates is sponsored by the Rosencrantz Foundation, and the proposition this time is tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary. The entry poll recorded the audience as in favor of the motion. 46% voted in favor, only 35% were against, and 19% were undecided. After the debate, they will vote again to see if the debaters were able to sway the audience with their arguments. The moderator for the night is Brooke Gladstone, host of NPR's On the Media. We'll hear from her later, but now we'll sample a few of the ideas that were presented in the opening statements. The first speaker of the night is Heather McDonald. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and she is speaking for the motion.
I will argue that stress interrogation techniques were both necessary for getting information from suspected terrorists after 9/11 and effective in doing so. I will base my arguments on the actual experience of interrogators in Afghanistan and elsewhere. This is not a debate about torture. The stress methods that interrogators developed, such as short periods of sleep deprivation and isolation, were light years from torture. The use of stress techniques on terrorists is lawful. The burden, therefore, falls on our opponents to explain why legal and essential methods to gain critical information about future terrorist attacks should be off limits. Uncertainty is an interrogator's most powerful ally. It can lead the detainee to believe that the interrogator is in total control and holds the key to his future. An interrogator facing a resistant Taliban explosives maker, for example, might angrily hoist the prisoner up by his collar and storm out of the interrogation booth. The detainee had previously understood that American interrogators couldn't so much as lay a finger on them. Suddenly, he doesn't know what the interrogator's limits are. That frightening uncertainty can change his calculations about whether to cooperate. According to interrogators in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, stress worked. The harsher the methods that the questioners used, the sooner they got good information. Eventually, the military codified a set of stress techniques for use in Guantanamo and Iraq. These included keeping a detainee awake at night, putting him on cold army rations instead of hot meals, isolation, environmental manipulation, and impersonating a foreign agent. All were hedged around with numerous bureaucratic and medical safeguards. None of the stress techniques that the military approved for use on terror detainees had anything to do with Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was the result of the unconscionable and culpable breakdown of military discipline throughout the detention camp.
That was Heather McDonald, and next we'll hear an excerpt from John Hudson's opening statement. He's dean and president of Franklin Pierce Law Center, and he's speaking against the motion, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary.
Gee, it all sounds so sweet and benign. Ask them a few questions, have them stand up for a while, make them take their shirt off, give them a little cold maybe. 300-pound Iraqi general, stuffed in headfirst into a sleeping bag, bound up with electrical wires, sat on by an Army warrant officer, released, put back in, died, dead. That was a stress position. Guy was prosecuted, got 6 months for some orders violations, but basically was released because it was an authorized stress position. By the DOD's own count, approximately 40 people have been killed in the hands of the United States in detention as homicides. So let's not kid ourselves that this is some sort of benign search for the truth. Torture was never intended to be that. Torture was intended originally to be an effort to get false confessions. You're a heretic, you're a traitor to the king, you're a witch. We've given a bad name to torture. We've misapplied torture. We're trying to use it to find the truth, for Pete's sake.
That was John Hudson. Now we'll hear from another speaker for the motion, Rick Francona. He's a retired Air Force intelligence officer, and he used part of his opening statement to discuss a bill that President Bush vetoed just 3 days before the debate. The bill would have limited the CIA to the Army's approved interrogation techniques.
Whatever line that is, I can tell you the line that the government is trying to draw is the Army Field Manual. I've worked under the Army Field Manual. It's pretty restrictive. The new one is even more restrictive. They rewrote it in November of 2006. It's online. Type in to Google Army Field Manual Interrogation. It's a voluminous document. It's written in typical Army bureaucraties. There's probably 4 pages in it worth reading. And those are the ones that tell you the 16 psychological approaches you can use, none of which will be effective against a terrorism suspect, because those techniques were written to break a captured enemy soldier, one probably with no resistance training whatsoever. I think the president was right to veto any bill that limits what the CIA can do. And this is only limiting the CIA. The entire Department of Defense is already constrained by the Army Field Manual. The idea is to extend that to the entire government. I think that's a mistake. We still have to have this tool in our arsenal.
That was Rick Francona. Next, we'll hear from Jack Clunan. He's a security expert and president of Clayton Consultants. He is speaking against the motion, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary.
I was charged in 1996 to eliminate bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, and others as a threat to U.S. national security. And I found myself in the enviable position of having traveled around the world and find members of al-Qaeda and gain their cooperation. And I can assure you, as I sit here tonight, being very proud of what the end result of that was, that I did not engage in any harsh interrogation techniques. Rapport building, treating people humanely, getting information is what we're after. There's too much at stake. Your safety is at stake to engage in harsh interrogation techniques, which is going to cause the enemy to seek revenge against each of you.
Also against the motion, here's Darius Rajali. He's a professor of political science at Reed College.
A World War II vet came up to me after a lecture I said, and he said, in France, we caught this German soldier, and we pulled a knife to his throat and said, where are the other soldiers? And I said, did you get good info? And he said, yeah, sort of. I said, I'm happy for you. I really am. Because if you had bad info, you'd be dead. The problem is that everyone who knows that torture doesn't work is dead. For those for whom it works are walking around saying it worked for me, it worked for them. This is what we call in social science a biased sample. If you take real data from the best studies, armies using torture who carefully and selectively selected suspects, the best case scenario that they managed to generate was 20 to 78 innocent people had to be tortured for each bad guy they got. 20 to 78 innocent people for each bad guy. Now,
in the question and answer period, moderator Brooke Gladstone asked a question of David Rifkin, whom we're hearing for the first time. He's a lawyer who served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, and he is for the motion, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary.
David? American leadership and our security, I think we can all agree, are based, at least in part, on our alliances. And if America is seen in its interrogation methods as a renegade, won't that endanger our leadership role and thus our security if we lose that moral high ground and that leadership?
Brooke, we certainly pay a high price for it, but a couple of things need to be mentioned. First of all, unfortunately, the critics that promiscuously lump together the kind of ordinary yelling, spittle flying, psychological pressure, modest sleep deprivation, and label it with a T word, are contributing to this problem. The notion that we as a society cannot draw nuances, cannot draw distinctions between a tough treatment and torture is frankly silly, because that's not what we do in ordinary life in any other difficult issues. But more importantly than that, I am not convinced that the alleged price we're paying for this aspect of our policy is sort of a but-for problem. There's so many other things but unfortunately, our friends and allies do not like, because they don't take the threat of radical Islam seriously. We don't believe in serious use of military power. They're beyond that. But if we took that off the table, it would make a difference. But the thing that makes me really angry is the notion that we are helping the recruitment of jihadis, because we're talking about a culture that countenances, without any problem, blowing up children, torturing American prisoners to death. So if you tell me that we're people who are not troubled by that, They think it's okay. But if they read about some level of sexual degradation, humiliation being inflicted on somebody by us, that really ticks them off. I will tell you, these are the people who are not going to win their hearts and minds no matter what try. I find this argument absolutely absurd. And the final point about how our soldiers are treated, ladies and gentlemen, our soldiers have been tortured in every single war since the end of World War II. So the notion that somehow there's this nirvana, tell this to John McCain. Tell people in Korea that over 50% of American POWs were tortured and stuffed to death. Look, we have to do the right thing because it's the right thing, but let's not pretend that it's going to impact how our people are going to be dealt with by this enemy.
Go ahead, Rick.
I think one of the points you were trying to make is that it will staunch the willingness of our allies to join with us in these coalitions. I think John, you said coalition is the way we're going to go in the future. I agree with that. But I don't think that this aspect is going to play that big of a role, because when you look at the interrogation techniques that our allies use, they're much tougher than we are. Look at the way the French interrogate. Look at the way the British interrogate. I think they go far beyond our Army Field Manual.
Heather McDonald.
I would also say, in one sense, I take John Hudson's argument as really a confirmation of what we're arguing, because you didn't address stress. You talked about clear abuses of the interrogation rules. There was no license for stuffing somebody in a sleeping bag and suffocating him to death. That was a violation of the rules, not a interrogation pursuant
Nobody
to them.
Nobody stopped it.
And people that have killed detainees have rightly been prosecuted. We are not arguing for torture. My side here is talking about stress interrogation, and I would say it is perfectly valid to distinguish between keeping somebody up late, according to the interrogators who have written about this and spoken about this, reversing somebody's sleep schedules does get information, and burning somebody or destroying them and inflicting deliberate severe pain and stress on them and suffering on them. We have to be able to make these distinctions.
These are excerpts from a live Intelligence Squared debate. We'll now return to the discussion with some comments from John Hudson, who is speaking against the motion.
The point is that this is not an existential war. World War II is an existential war. The Civil War is an existential war. This just happens to be the present war. And for us to sit here in 2008 and turn these people into supermen that the Nazis and Imperial Japan was not is just kidding ourselves. The problem that we face now is that nobody in the administration has said stop. Nobody said they may be terrorists, they may be evildoers, but they're human beings, and we will treat them with the dignity and respect that Americans have always treated human beings. Instead, we just let it run rampant. Not because we said, go out and torture, because we didn't. I mean, I'd like to have a nickel for every time the president said, the United States doesn't torture. We don't engage in extraordinary rendition. But the reality of it is, what was going on there continued on. You look at the pictures at Abu Ghraib, you listen to the stories of what happened at Guantanamo, gloves off, fear down, and it was pretty clear that if it wasn't the express policy, it was the benign policy of the United States to engage in techniques that we had absolutely forbidden. In 1903, we sent an American major to prison for 10 years for waterboarding, a Filipino. We prosecuted Japanese for waterboarding and sent them to prison.
Heather McDonald.
John, to say we've let it run rampant is just not true. People that have abused prisoners have been prosecuted criminally. When Abu Ghraib
came out, there has been
investigation after investigation of that. I would agree. I think Abu Ghraib, there has not been sufficient responsibility laid on the commanders that let that situation get out of control. I think it needs to go way far up the Pentagon chain of command that it hasn't. But again, that happened in contravention of the interrogation rules. The interrogation rules, if they had been followed to the letter, they said that every interrogation technique had to be cleared, had to be monitored. What was going on was not interrogation. This was a bunch of deranged, sadistic guards working in the middle of the night that were getting their jollies on these prisoners. It had nothing to do with the interrogation
rules. Rick?
And I think we need to put this Abu Ghraib thing to rest. And you're absolutely right. This was not the interrogations we're talking about. This was a bunch of military policemen running amok. It was a breakdown of where were their officers? Where were the NCOs? It was a complete breakdown of the chain of command. It was set up by the command in Baghdad. And there have been careers ruined for this. General Sanchez is out of the Army now. And he's set up an unworkable chain of command. He put the intelligence people in charge of the prison. You don't do that.
And here's another question from moderator Brooke Gladstone.
To get an answer, and I'm going to address the same question to both sides. And that is this foe different from the other foes that we faced? This foe has stated, especially the high-value prisoners, those on the inside of al-Qaeda have stated that they are ready for death. Can you break this foe by building a rapport? Rick?
Yeah, I'll take that. Ideally, you want to break any foe. And Jack, I agree that rapport building, if you have time, is the best way to go. The point is sometimes you don't have the time. But I believe the foe is a different one than we've ever faced before. We're not dealing with a state. We're not dealing with someone with defined borders. These are not soldiers in an army. These are committed warriors in a religious battle. And I think that brings something that we've never dealt with before, and I don't think we're very well prepared to do that.
And can I also add, this is an asymmetrical war. The destructive power that now lies available to individuals that are not a member of the state, that cannot be deterred as states can, is unlike anything that we've faced before with the availability of nuclear weapons.
Our distinguished colleagues don't have their act together.
David Rifkin.
Jack seems to be arguing that it is silly to counterproductively use stress techniques and accomplish a lot of rapport. Nobody disagrees. Nobody would be a fool to suggest we should promiscuously use stress techniques. But it's equally foolish to say we should never use them, because there may be circumstances where they're necessary. And the true wisdom lies in ascertaining which one is which. And mistakes can be made. But wouldn't it be a mistake, Jack, to just take something entirely off the table? Do you think that everybody is subject to
that's
being...
a sentence?
Let me address this to Jack first, because you raised the issue of rapport building as an effective way to get actionable intelligence.
It's the only effective
way. That's not what I'm saying. I used the word rapport building, certainly. Did I engage in harsh interrogation techniques? Of course I did. But harsh doesn't mean that I was engaging in sleep deprivation. It doesn't mean that I was engaging in some of these other techniques that we've now all identified. The harshest thing I ever had to do was to let somebody listen to Barry Manilow for 24 hours. That would be considered...
Sounds awful.
You know, doesn't it? Honestly. No, what I'm saying is that there is this supposition out there that al-Qaeda is everywhere. There's this supposition that the Taliban is al-Qaeda, and we fail to make distinctions between that. If I asked the audience tonight, and I'll ask my distinguished colleagues up here, and David, you can be the first one, how many members of al-Qaeda do you think there are?
Oh, boy. Is this a multiple choice?
I mean, the other side is arguing that this enemy is so vast, so depraved, they want to kill thousands of us. There's no question about that. We saw that. But my point to you is, when I took the original membership list off of Ali Muhammad for al-Qaeda, there were 72 members.
There's probably a lot more now.
Well,
The cell structure within al-Qaeda consists of 4 to 6 operatives. You are trying to find, on a beach, a small dime. That's what we're up against.
Heather McDonald.
But, Jack, that's a different argument. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they have 1 million or 10,000. Again, given the availability of weapons of mass destruction, that's what we're up against, and that's the fear that
a small number of people... What are the weapons of mass destruction that they have? Airplanes?
There is the possibility
of nuclear weapons. Oh, come on,
You think it's not going to happen?
Rick may know this. Al-Qaeda first tried to get fissionable material in 1993. What they got was red mercury. They got scammed. And we got that from what? We got that from one of the guys that we cooperated with. So not only did we learn about what they were trying to do, we knew how they went about it.
I hope that will prompt the audience.
That was Jack Clunan, and you're listening to an Intelligence Squared debate on the proposition tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary. Next, we'll hear a question from the audience.
Have we got a question ready?
The arguments on both sides so far have been mostly utilitarian. Torture works, torture doesn't work, torture has side effects, but there hasn't been much said about the moral high ground and America showing leadership in an ethical and moral universe. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What about the moral issue in here, which I think is a problem that many of us have?
Can I just say very briefly, let the record show that nobody's arguing on our side in favor of torture. The shame, frankly, the fault lies with the critics that damn everything with a T word and paint with a broad brush. We're not talking about torture. We're talking about the level of coerciveness and unpleasantness that permeates other spheres of public life without drawing any opposition from anybody. You tell me why, in order for us to occupy the moral high ground, we should eschew, give up, whatever verb you want to use, the level of coercion that is routinely used in other areas, including training of our own troops, specialized and advanced training, federal and state penitentiaries, boot camps for juvenile offenders. That makes no sense for us as a society to, instead of having a common baseline, but it's not torture, to have privilege, uniquely privileged, only one set of people captured Al-Qaeda and Taliban terrorists. If that is morality, it's silly.
That's David Rifkin. Darius Rajali, do you want to try this one on?
Sure, I'll take that on. Look, you keep on saying that we do these things domestically and we should do them internationally, and what's the problem? Well, a couple of problems. First of all, let me just say a couple of things. If a young professor comes to me and he says, can you tell me exactly what sexual harassment is? I mean, if I do a little bit of it, is it okay? You'd think that's creepy, right? These people are talking about, let's do a little bit of it, and it's creepy, and it should creep you out, okay? Because there are certain things you shouldn't get anywhere near. The line between domestic and international, whatever you want to call these things, not torture, is a thin one. In every war that we have used torture, the Philippines, when we use that in insurgency, those guys, they come home, what kind of jobs do they get? They get jobs as policemen, prison guards, and your private security officials. And behind them follows torture, or not torture, call it what you will. Chicago is paying $20 million, thanks to Mr. Burge and his 50 detectives, who brought all their lovely techniques back from Vietnam. Look, at the end of this war, whether these guys get their way or not, people are coming back, and they're going to be your cops, your neighborhood officials. They're going to be your private people. And yes, there is a difference between domestic and international, but this stuff travels.
Darius, do you
let me make another point, too. If this is important for us to do, to save American lives, because we've got this superhuman enemy that we have never faced before, because this foe is different, and they are so dedicated, if this is important for us to do at some level, then to the moral imperative question, why should we stop at all? Why not the rack? Why not perfidy? Why not treachery? Why not all kinds of things? Because if that's the moral thing to do in order to save lives, then by George, we ought to be doing it across the board and not stopping ourselves anywhere short. I think that the world has relied on us to stand for the rule of law and for human rights. And it's not a rule of law if you only apply it when it's convenient. And it's not a human right if it only applies to some people. We need to stand tall in this and not draw lines, because this enemy is the worst enemy we have ever faced.
Let me just argue that, first of all, what we are doing is within the rule of law, because a terrorist detainee is not covered by the Geneva Conventions.
It's how you define the law.
He is covered by the Convention Against Torture. There is no question. We are obligated to follow the Convention Against Torture. That's why it matters to make the distinctions that Darius refuses to. We are not arguing torture on this side. And Darius, you seem to think that the only possible set of questioning techniques are these random, it was rather arbitrary what got put into the Army Field Manual. There has been no serious empirical work, even on the Army Field Manual. Are you suggesting that those are the only possible questioning techniques that can ever be used? There may have been 12. If Mutt and Jeff had not originally been included in them, My guess is that if we were now
Mudd and Jeff proposing are good cop, bad cop, people who don't know these.
You would call that torture as well, because that wouldn't be
no,
in the
actually,
Army Field
Heather,
Manual.
I think you're getting your distinctions
again,
quite all confused
to, we
here.
We need to discuss whether stress is torture.
Listen,
I'm the one who argued for public cooperation because Al-Qaeda is like a fish in a sea. You need to push it out of the water. It's a small group of people, and you need to have Iraqi civilians come in and turn people in. I have not been the one who argued for the interrogation manual. I have said that all the studies show that unless you have public cooperation on your side, the chances that you will be able to clear and solve a crime will fall to 10% regardless of how you interrogate them, right? So it doesn't matter what you throw at this problem, right? And the more you do your not torture stuff, the more problematic it is. Let me get to another thing. Barbaric, different kind of enemy, sure. They're vengeful. And in the Middle East, they never forget. You know this. Do they have weapons of mass destruction? Well, as I understand, Mr. Al-Libi, after he was beaten up by the Egyptians, said that Saddam Hussein trained Al-Qaeda in weapons of biological and chemical destruction. The Pentagon produced this huge report that proved that this was entirely false, but it went into the president's speech in October in 2002, and it was part of the case that took us to war. And let me tell you, I don't know how many lives these not torture techniques have saved, but I can tell you how many lives it's taken. It's taken everybody who's died.
All right. Think about it.
That was Darius Rajali. Now, we'll hear a section of the debate where the debaters question their opponents. Here's Heather McDonald. She's for the motion, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary.
I'm just puzzled by the idea that if you have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in detention, I'm not sure what the public cooperation is that you're going to expect to get information from him. The 9/11 Commission report, you're claiming that interrogation stress did not work. They said that half of the information in that report came from the interrogation of
high
value.
Is that the
question? Yeah. Why are you disagreeing with the fact that the interrogation of high value detainees did produce valuable intelligence that allowed us to?
In the case of Abu Zubaydah, the information that was of high value was not stuff that he gave up after he was waterboarded. The real critical stuff was in the apartment where he was seized. He jumped out the back window, and in the apartment was a treasure trove of computers, documents, cell phones, and the like. And so when they started to do their routine grunt work and do the document exploitation and all that other stuff, that's what led ultimately to the arrest, if you will, or the capture of Khalid Sheikh and Ramzi bin al-Shib.
That was Jack Clunan. John Hudson, have you got a question for the side in favor of the proposition?
Yes. There's been a lot of talk about the Army Field Manual and the difference now between DOD and the CIA. The president just recently vetoed the intelligence bill, which would have made the CIA subject to the Army Field Manual. The intelligence bill that would have incorporated the Army Field Manual has the following prohibitions. Which of these prohibitions would you say is okay for the CIA and therefore for the United States? This is what the president vetoed. Forcing a prisoner to be naked, perform sexual acts, or pose in a sexual manner. Placing hoods or sacks over the head of a prisoner and using duct tape over their eyes. Applying beatings, electric shots, burns, and other forms of physical pain. Waterboarding, military working dogs, hypothermia or heat injury, mock executions, and depriving a prisoner of necessary food, water, and medical care. Now, which of those do you think it's okay for the CIA on behalf of the United States to engage in order to get information?
Rick, do you want to take that one?
Well, since I think he's reading from my article.
No, actually, I'm not.
That's the field manual, right? This is what the Army is prohibited from doing. I'm not saying the CIA should be allowed to do any or all of these. I'm just saying you shouldn't extend this manual to the CIA. The CIA operates under different rules.
But you
want to go through and then the CIA manual could be more specific.
He gave you a multiple choice question here because these were this bill was vetoed.
But that's, with all due respect, John, that's not all that the Army Field Manual does. My favorite example is, I wish I had it in front of
David Rifkin.
If you look at the definition of a good cop versus bad cop, there's a restriction on how bad a bad cop can be. The bad cop cannot act in a manner that's disrespectful to the person being interrogated. I would submit to you, it's not a question of violating the law on the domestic side. In virtually every police station, the bad cop is pretty damn disrespectful to the drug dealers and rapists and muggers. We're talking about using the rules. We're not using our criminal justice system. That, John, is absurd. It's insanity. It's not morality.
But he's citing the...
But he's citing selectively. The Army Field Manual.
And he's asking you to respond selectively.
Well, I feel as though I have to defend all the good police officers and law enforcement officers out there, because I can assure you that doesn't go on as much as David suggested it does. It just doesn't.
Bad cop does not yell.
No,
spittle is not
flying. I'm saying, but...
Threats are not made.
But you keep...
We're
you
not
keep
allowed
talking,
to even
You keep talking in, about these extreme views. You keep talking in the extreme. What I'm trying to argue here is, and I think we've done it rather successfully, frankly, is to tell you that when you speak in the extremes and you speak in the absolutes, that there is going to be problems. I don't think
These are excerpts of a live Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. The moderator for the night is NPR's Brooke Gladstone. And here is David Rifkin. He is for the motion, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary, and he's asking a question of the opposing side.
Against the motion.
Why do you claim that false, misleading information and lying only emanates from people who are being interrogated stressfully? Well, last time I checked, every criminal, every terrorist routinely lies, and your job as interrogator is to sift the truth from fiction. Isn't it the case that the biggest problem is the person says nothing, zero, nada? Not the fact that somebody is lying, because you have enough time to cross-reference things. You can learn as much from lying as from a person doing truth-telling. But everybody lies.
Okay. Does anybody want?
No kidding.
Yeah. Yes. Well, look, there's lots of collection.
Bad guys,
the question
bad
is analysis.
Guys lie.
Look, the guilty will lie no more nor less. The problem is a selection problem. You have a fuzzy context in which you can't tell who is a big fish, who's a small fish, who is not Al-Qaeda, who isn't. These are people who hide as ordinary civilians. You've all admitted this, right? So you have a selection problem. You have to pull in large numbers of people, and there you have to decide who is guilty and who is innocent. The guilty, you're right, absolutely will lie no more or less if you do whatever you want to do to them, right? But the innocent, oh my God, if you start torturing the innocent, you're going to produce a mound of false information. You're weighing down the exact war effort you want to win. And not only that, I ask you, what American value does it promote to torture 20 to 78 innocents to get your one hit?
Actually, Darius, it's your time to ask a
question.
Asked that question. Do you want to ask that? Yeah. Do you guys get that?
But that's a straw man. Nobody is suggesting that. This administration, that's much maligned, has used the stress interrogation techniques against very few high-value detainees. And whether or not a given individual, as Jack suggested, was more of a braggart or versus a real mastermind, he wasn't innocent. The few people who were subjected to those techniques were anything but innocent.
Look,
you're a torturer. You know, it's a one-time deal. If it's not necessarily counting or saying, well, these people above this line are high values, so we can torture them. Below this line, they're not. So, you know, once you've done it, once you've engaged in it, that's who you are as a nation.
John,
and
you
got to deal with
this. This is what you are suggesting we're doing. First of all, you guys don't have your act together. The two people on both sides are making a utilitarian argument. It doesn't work. We don't need it. You're making an absolute argument that there are certain things called torture that you should never do. Actually, we agree. The question is this. Are we going to be a mature society to have a serious discourse about what isn't torture? It's distasteful, but it's necessary. We're going to just flap our hands and say everything is torture.
Well, no, a mature society has a debate about what good counterterrorism policy is, not what good torture is.
Rick, have you...
That's
Rick,
true.
Well, I'm sorry. Hold on a moment. Rick Francona, do you have a question?
Darius, you said that you use the public cooperation is how you would round these guys up. I'm not sure that's always the case. Would you say that's why Al-Qaeda in Iraq is being taken apart by the Anbar cooperative group out there? They're doing it because we're going to kill them, not because we're not going to be nice to them.
You know, one of the nasty things about Al-Qaeda, and this is true about all terrorist torture, let's be clear, these people are barbarians, right? They chop off heads. They're incompetent at it. They know they're going to get a rise out of us. Beheading is ridiculous, as it's clearly a bait, and it's clearly designed to get us to make mistakes. Now, One of the things any Oriental ruler would have known is not to fall for that bait, right? Terrorists don't have fixed assets. They don't have jails. They don't have places. They have to be on the run. They have to depend on safe houses. What I'm finding right now in Al Anbar is we're finding torture chambers. You know what that means? It means they're feeling comfortable enough to build torture chambers. That is not good.
Oh, wait a minute. It doesn't work, so it must hurt them more than it helps them.
It works. I'll tell you what it works for. It works to intimidate. It works to make false confessions. I am happy to stipulate that, although I will say this, too. We have all the records of French torture from the Ancien Régime, and we know that these guys boiled people's feet in oil. They waterboarded. Do you know how many actually said anything? Do we have a single document left of them in confession? 3 to 14%. That's what false confessions are. Now, let's not even worry about the true and false confessions. The other part of this is you think that, well, if the guy breaks, oh, I'll know whether it's true or not. Again, 40 years of psychological research will tell you this. We're really, really bad at telling the difference between truth and lies, even interrogators. We've tested them. I'm sorry. There is no argument here.
Jack Clunan, please direct the next question.
I'll direct this to Rick. Rick, what is the best way to get quality, actionable intelligence to protect this audience?
I don't think there's an argument. I agree with what you said. Establishing rapport.
Come sit over here.
Rick, I don't understand what you're doing over there. I honestly don't.
There's a comma here. given, you know, in a perfect world. And if you had time to establish that rapport. But many times, you're not sure you have the time to do that. The biggest problem is not what you know about a suspect. It's about what you don't know. And what you don't know is what's the timeline. And you have to get to that very quickly. And if you have any reason to believe that he's got information of an imminent value, then you've got to ramp up the treatment. Ideally, if you think this guy, okay, this is a low-level Taliban guy who probably doesn't know much, let's sit down and talk to him and find out who we might know, where the training camps are, the routine order of battle kind of stuff you'd want to prosecute a war. But if you grab a guy, maybe Bin Laden's driver, who was driving a set of orders somewhere, but you don't know where, it'd be nice to know where that is before the action happens.
Heather McDonald.
Obviously, we do need to think about this not just as a utilitarian matter, but a moral one. But why is it necessarily the moral position to say that we are not going to use stress on a single al-Qaeda detainee and risk the possible destruction of hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent civilians? To me, it's not clear that the moral position puts more value on the protecting of temporary extreme discomfort of one person who is pledged to destroy as many Americans as he can, that's moral to protect him and to sacrifice thousands of American lives. The idea that stress does not work, never works, is an easy out. The fact is that regimes have used torture, again, which is not what we are arguing for today, but even torture has been shown to work. The French used it in the Algerian War, and they got information.
No.
They did.
They
used.
Let's hear that one. Let's hear the evidence. Let's hear the evidence. 24,000 police arrest, let's call them torture warrants, right? To catch what? How many in the Kasbah? Do you know how many there were? You guys don't know how many al-Qaeda there were.
I actually do.
Okay. There were.
We are ready now for
1,400.
1,400.
24,000 tortured for 1,400, most of whom actually died and went actually over to the French as informers.
We've run nearly out of time.
You're listening to an IQ Squared debate on the proposition tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary. We'll now hear excerpts of the closing statements. Each speaker has 2 minutes, and they alternate between the two sides. We'll start with John Hudson speaking against the motion.
Thank you, and thank you all for your patience. The enemy can't beat us militarily. They've got no lift. They've got very little communication. They've got IEDs. They've got suicide bombers. They cannot defeat the United States of America militarily. But I'll tell you how we can lose this war on terror. We can commit national suicide. And the way we'll commit national suicide is by disarming ourselves, by giving up our greatest weapon. And our greatest weapon isn't our military might or our natural resources. It sure as heck isn't our economy right now. Our great strength is who we are. And if we give up who we are as a nation, that's a victory for the enemy. The enemy knows they can't defeat us militarily. Killing us isn't their goal. The enemy's goal in the war on terror is to bring us down to them, to make us ever so slightly more like they are, to make us as miserable and pathetic as they are. And if we engage in the same tactics, they will have won that particular battle.
Thank you very much, John Hudson. Now, Heather McDonald for the motion.
Well, I agree with the opponents that we need as highly trained interrogators as we can get. They should be as fully versed in language and cultural skills, and that is clearly has been a weakness. But I would submit that the trained interrogators with the CIA were facing resistance, that the existing tools that they had available to them was not able to overcome. And I don't believe that the 16 Army interrogation rules are the only possible interrogation techniques that should ever be available as we face an enemy that is not going to seek revenge because we are using stress, because they wanted to kill us 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and destroy as much as we can. I think that there are going to be times when stress is necessary. If we are facing an imminent threat, if we have somebody with knowledge of the next plot, we're not going to have time to spend the months that it can take to build rapport. And if using stress on somebody with knowledge of the next terrorist attack is necessary to save thousands of American lives, I think that it is acceptable and lawful and moral to do so.
Against the motion, Darius Rajali.
Is it better to be loved or feared? Loved or feared? The correct answer is that if you can fight with one hand tied behind your back and win, you will be loved and feared. And that's the American way. If you want to be merely loved, you'll be despised. If you really want to be feared, you'll be despised. My great-grandfather wanted to be feared. He was a very powerful Persian prince. He didn't hesitate to torture and kill anyone who got in his way. He clothed his values in blood. And no one misses him today, and his world is gone. I accepted this invitation today, regardless of this debate, win or lose, just to tell you all one thing I know. Don't make the same mistake my great-grandfather did. Don't make the same mistake the Shah of Iran did. No one will miss you either. Do not close the values that I have come to this country for. Do not close them in blood and make them a sham. I am really tired of having to move. And your parents were really tired of having to move. Look, you can follow bagpipes into battle if you want, but the reality doesn't change. In the end, the Pied Piper keeps on playing all that hot air, the boys at the front die, and the Pipers go back to the think tanks and have fine careers. You can't win a football game with a bunch of Hail Marys. You can't do it based on interrogation, based on faith. We've told you the only thing that really works: public cooperation, rapport building. And if you're still on the fence and you don't know where to vote, I just have it on good authority, by the way, that Rick Francona is a card-carrying member of Red Sox Nation.
For the motion, David Rifkin.
We are facing a very serious threat. One of the reasons that is the case is not a question of numbers. It's not even a question of technology. It's the question of dedication. It's been decades since we fought people who, no matter how twisted and warped the ideology is, willing to commit the most inhuman acts, sacrificing not only themselves, mothers bringing their children up to die, expressing pride at that. The force of that compulsion, of that conviction, is tremendously dangerous. I would suggest to you that we had a lot of emotional statements today, in my opinion, not emanating from our side of this equation, but I ask you to use your rule of reason. We as human beings are all about making nuances. Of we're dealing with our kids, our coworkers, dealing with our government. What we've heard repeatedly from our opponents is extolling you not to try to draw distinctions, not to try to rule the rule of reason, but basically adopt a rigid, unyielding framework, suggesting that anything that deviates from this framework, but degrees of coercion, which, by the way, if practiced in the criminal justice system, would absolutely allow most criminals to go free because would not be able to suggest them to any psychological coercion or threaten them or their family members in any way. That is not the way America has gotten to where it is. This is not the way you're going to lead your own lives. This is not the way you're going to lead your professional lives. Why should you lead that approach as citizens of his great party polity? Use the rule of reason.
Against the motion, Jack Lunin.
I think, honestly, that we all on this stage tonight have learned something about each other, and I think that we all want to get to the same position. I firmly believe that. I think that we have a different way of going about it, and we may differ in methodology. I believe, on our side, in our argument, and I'm not making this just based on moral grounds, I'm making this from the position of a utilitarian, practical application of what I know to work. And that because we have such a huge deficit in our ability to collect solid, good intelligence, I don't want to waste the time trying to find that little dime I mentioned to you on the beach. We don't have time to do that. The enemy, as David suggested, is very committed. Bin Laden has issued a fatwa, and in that fatwa he has declared war on the United States, and he has said that it's the duty of every good Muslim to kill Americans wherever they find them. The question is, how am I going to protect you? How is our government going to protect you? And the best way to do that, it seems to me, is what we've been advocating on this side. Let's be clear. Stress can be defined any number of different ways. What we're talking about are extreme measures, and those extreme measures don't work. Haven't worked, and it sets us up for cataclysmic results, which means revenge of the worst sort. And we haven't seen the worst yet. We haven't seen the repercussions of what Abu Ghraib has represented in others. Trust me when I say that.
For the motion, Rick Francona.
I was struck by your question, sir, and I really appreciate you asking that about the moral high ground. Do we lose by not adhering to the moral high ground? Trust me, and I think all of us are on the same sheet. No one wants to use these techniques as a matter of course. No one enjoys this. From those of us who have done this, it's not a very pleasant experience. But we don't live in a perfect world. We didn't create that world, and it is inhabited by people that do want to kill us. And I'm not sure revenge is the factor. It's their stated goal in life for whatever reason. Is this utilitarian? Yes. It's the mission of the intelligence community and the armed forces to protect the country through whatever means is legally possible. And when you're lucky enough to get your hands on one of these suspects, and it's very difficult to do, how do you find them? These are all very good points. Once you get your hands on one, you have to be able to get the information you need. If the rapport building works, great. If it doesn't, you've got to be able to ratchet it up and get what you have to have. They can't defeat us militarily, but I am not willing to risk the death of thousands of Americans just on the moral high ground. You can't have it both ways.
And that concludes our debate.
Thank you very much.
When the audience had finished voting on the proposition, tough interrogation of terror suspects is necessary, the speakers against the motion had swayed the audience to their side. The entry poll, again, was 46% for the motion and 35% against. At the end, the audience voted only 40% for the motion and 53% were against. 7% still didn't know. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series or to find out how you can get tickets to future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's IQ, the numeral 2, US.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC in New York, producer Rob Christensen, executive producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore, Edward Haber, and Greg Gavin. Intelligence Squared US is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.